Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Coming up later in the program, the benefits of vitamin D. But up front, many of us have been isolated from our families, coworkers, and classmates over the past 7 months because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Social interactions at work or school or for just seeing friends and family have been greatly reduced. Human beings are social animals, and we crave those interactions. Maybe more than just wanting them, we may need them for our own mental and even physical well-being. Our guest today began by studying the consequences of isolation and rural poverty. Now they've turned their sights on isolation during the pandemic. Joining us, Dr. Laura Brighton Granruth, Associate Professor and Master of Social Work Director at Millersville University. Dr. Granruth, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Scott.
And Dr. Jennifer Frank, Assistant Professor in the Social Work Department. She also is at Millersville University. Dr. Frank, good to have you on today's program.
Thanks for having us, Scott.
So let's start with what you were studying. You were studying the effects of poverty in rural areas. What made you want to take on research in social isolation during the pandemic?
That's a great question. So really, I teach a course on poverty, and in 2015, when we were kind of developing the course, we wanted to teach the students about empathy and how do we have empathy. And so I met with a local agency, and we planned a project where we could have dinner with the folks that utilize the services at their organization. And so we had this dinner, and we were really studying rural poverty, and we were studying how the students interact with people. As a result of that, we wanted to get more people involved in the dinner, and so we added a pen pal component where students were then writing letters back and forth with folks from the organization before our dinner. And we really just used that because we wanted to get more people to attend, but we found a lot of information in our letters told us about human interaction and the kinds of things that people need on a daily basis. And so that's when we turned our research into understanding the nature of those human interactions. Last year, then, we also did some interviews with folks who live in the area, and we learned a lot about rural poverty and social isolation, which relates to our pandemic now.
So, yeah, I would imagine it relates to the pandemic. And it's not just those who are living in poverty. Are you just studying that segment of the population or the population overall and how this isolation has impacted them?
So I would say really we were studying the rural area and we were studying social isolation before the pandemic. And when we were writing about it last spring, we were like, wow, this is really interesting because the kinds of things that the folks we talk to and the kinds of isolation they've been experiencing is very relatable now to everybody because everybody's been isolated. And it almost is sort of like this call to action around isolation because everybody now can have empathy about the kinds of things that folks in rural areas have been experiencing for a long time.
But you're not psychologists. You work in the area of social work. When you're studying how the pandemic and isolation has impacted a lot of people, what are you looking for through the eyes of someone who works in social work?
I think that's a great question, Scott, because as social workers, we're always looking at the person in their environment and the resources that they either have access to or don't have access to. And so, on a different kind of twist from psychology, social workers are looking at kind of the big picture. And the folks that we talk to really were talking about a disconnect. They were disconnected not only from the resources that they need. A lot of folks talked a lot about transportation and getting food and kind of like the basic need, their basic needs met. But they really talked about the human interaction and friends and how do they get access to those kinds of things.
Dr. Frank, you did a lot of the writing on the poverty project. What have you found so far in your research on how this pandemic and isolation has impacted people?
Yeah, again, I think it has to do with how do they, you know, get their needs met in light of this. And I think access to resources is a big thing for people. Obviously, even when we talk about like access to transportation in the area where we did our study, it's very, very rural, and so people have trouble getting what they need. And even in regular times, right, because we're talking about, like, the bus doesn't go there or the bus goes there once a day or something like that. But now in the times that we're living, it's almost like, you know, we don't even want to ride the bus because you don't want to be that in close proximity to people. And so I think it has a lot to do, you know, with access to resources. And also we found a lot about human connections and the kinds of things that people can connect about.
And if I may, Jen and Scott, this year when we went to repeat the project, because it's a multi-year project, we almost can't because we were having an increasing number of people who wanted to participate in this project because they so enjoyed the connection with the students. And, of course, we're using old-fashioned letter writing. So, you know, when we want to talk about different modes or techniques of communication, and this semester, this year, the community members who we would usually be getting letters from can't even get to a place where they can either submit their letter, have their letter received, or if they needed help writing a letter. So instead of having 24 or 30 letters, we have 6, which is also another indication that that these community members can't even get into the agency where they usually go to have some sort of social interaction.
Why did you decide to go with, as you called it, old-fashioned letter writing?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm assuming that these letters are being sent by mail. Why did you decide to go that route?
Well, I can take that a little, Jen, if you want. I think it kind of evolved naturally of that this was sometime. Well, we go with old-fashioned letter writing because we have some concerns that we don't want students giving out their email addresses and we don't want them to have the email, you know, contact. So we've got issues around professional boundaries and privacy and everything else. And then some people, you know, of course, they don't have access to the Internet with rural broadband. And then it was a matter of a technique that was available to everyone, and some people had to come into the agency and actually dictate their letters to someone else. And we really went with this as a way to maintain privacy. That way we held on to the letters that the students, you know, wouldn't be taking them and doing other things with them, and also just to maintain it. And what came out there was just very low barrier access to, hi, how are you? What sports teams do you like? What music do you like to listen to? And probably one of our favorite examples is a gentleman who listed all his favorite songs and said, I know I may be older than you, but please go look up ABBA on YouTube, and please go look up John Denver on YouTube. And it was all these low barrier, easy access, what do you like? And from the student perspective, they expected that these community members would say, I wake up every day and think, oh, wow, I live in poverty and my life is hard and I'm in a bad mood and all I think about is my poverty. And instead, it was like, no, my life, you know, I've got some challenges, but I could really use some friends.
Couple things there. What you describe, and you know, we probably can't label everyone or paint with a broad brush, but what you describe with those letters sounds like some people who are lonely and just are looking for people to talk to. Would you agree with
absolutely
that?
Absolutely.
That's what we found. You know, people were lonely. We actually left the prompts very minimal because we wanted to explore, like, what is it that people just decide to talk about? And what came out of that, like Laura had mentioned, is these low-barrier topics. Everyone's talking about their pets. Everyone's talking about, like, their hobbies and stuff like that. But really, they're talking about, I'd like a friend. And I would like, you know, to have some human relationships and connection with people, especially when they're living in rural areas and they're far away from their neighbors.
Mm. So to turn it to what's going on right now, the people that you were communicating with through letters, and we've established that a lot of them sounded like they were lonely. What about now? I mean, even people who, and I go back to what I had said earlier about even people who may not be living in poverty, but maybe, I hate to say cooped up in a house, but how many times have we heard that term being used over the past 7 months? But I think about people in nursing homes. I think about people in hospitals that can't see their loved ones, that there appears to be a lot of loneliness right now.
We absolutely agree, which is, you know, as you know, scholars and researchers, although we had started looking in one area, in one rural area, you know, all, and as we went further into the project and actually went out into the community and started doing some interviews, when this hit, it hit us of like, oh my gosh, you know, what's not only what has happened for these folks we were already involved with who had already identified, you know, severe loneliness and isolation, but as you said, that now this is a an issue for the cities. If you're in an apartment and you can't get out, you know, think about folks in New York City who, you know, could have a real small apartment or in Lancaster City and you can't get out as much. Or so it is. I think it's across the board, and that's really what hit us of, you know, when we originally thought we might be pushing up against saying, hey, for this group of vulnerable people, let's decrease their social isolation. Now every more and more people can feel very connected to that and understand what it's like because we are all experiencing it.
Now, as you said, I mean, as we established, you are not psychologists, you're social workers, but have you noticed, observed any more depression when the people that you're hearing who are isolated?
Well, I think the research shows that, and, you know, social work can be a broad field that there's, you know, a lot of people are clinical social workers, so our colleagues and whatnot. So although we were not looking at, you know, giving them depression scales or whatnot, absolutely. Actually, NPR, the main NPR, had been doing some shows on isolation and depression, and so we know that some current research is showing that many people are reporting increased levels of depression, maybe tied to loneliness, maybe not. But yes, so the current research is beginning to show that.
You know, something else that strikes me, too, is not only are people isolated, watching more TV, maybe reading more books, finding ways to pass the time. If they have children at home, they are probably working on them and their school classes. But the news is so bad today. I mean, there's not a lot of good news out there, too. And even if people weren't isolated, but were just following the news, that could contribute to their loneliness and their depression.
Would you agree? Sure. Oh, absolutely. You know, it's like, can we have one more unprecedented thing? I often joke that I'm going to ban the word unprecedented after 2020. that it's because this, how much could be upon people? If you do have TV, but you are isolated, you could really get very depressed if you can't, access positive news. I think that takes me back to that people would love to have someone to write a letter with and get a letter in the mail.
Yeah.
So Jen and I had been thinking about, like, you know, what are some other opportunities, you know, but even though there may be lots of people who don't write letters anymore, you know, could churches get together and do some sort of letter writing group, other community groups? I mean, even for the, as you mentioned earlier, Scott, for the people who are in the nursing homes and isolated from their family members, you know, maybe getting a letter from even someone else, you know, school kids who are back with hybrid learning or something to get people connected, or just some thoughts we've had about because, you know, you don't have to go visit, but somebody can get a letter in the mail.
We'll talk more.
Yeah, I think that's what's really great about letter writing. It doesn't matter if you have access to the internet, because a lot of people, like the folks that we worked with, some of them don't have access to the internet. And even right now, if you do have access to the internet, everyone is tired of Zoom. So, like, to look at a piece of paper might be a welcome relief.
You know, and something, just a personal observation, because letter writing is such a lost art, so many people communicate via email or Facebook or other social media today. And, you know, there are a lot of ways that you can be creative with that. A letter just seems to be more personal because it is something that is a little bit old-fashioned, and it shows that someone has taken the time to sit down, and maybe they write in cursive, maybe they don't, that they have taken the time to sit down with a pen and paper, put it in the mail, put a stamp on it, and send it to you, even if it's a card. I don't know. It just would seem to me that that would mean more than getting an email saying, how are you doing today? Even though that, you know, that can be appreciated, but still a letter just seems like it would be something that someone who is lonely or hasn't seen a letter in a while can really appreciate. Would you agree with that?
I agree with that, absolutely, because even some of the letters that we had, a couple folks like drew a picture. And one of the ladies that we work with is an artist, a professional artist, drew a beautiful picture for the student, you know, and it was really, really special. I did have, and you said about writing in cursive, which is funny because some of the students had trouble reading cursive and said, are you serious, Dr. Frank? Like, I can't read this, you know, so like, and writing back by hand is a challenge, right? Because everyone's so used to typing. But what's nice about that, it's very equalizing. Everyone has access to it. And like you said, it's personalized, and people can it feel like somebody spent some time like just because of them.
Yeah. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guest during this portion of the program is Dr. Laura Brierton Granruth, who is Associate Professor and Master of Social Work Director, and Dr. Jennifer Frank, Assistant Professor in the Social Work Department, both at Millersville University. We're talking about research that they've been doing here recently on isolation due to the pandemic. And before that, a project that has been going on for several years had to do with poverty and people in poverty. We've been talking about writing letters, how they communicated, how students communicated with those who are living in rural areas, and find this really interesting. You know, I'm curious, right now, things are so abnormal. And Dr. Granruth, I'm not going to use the word unprecedented for this. I'll just say they're so abnormal. Things are so abnormal right now. What are social workers doing during this time, and how are they communicating with their clients?
Well, that's a great question. So, you know, human service agencies, of course, they're open, you know, but it's been challenging for many of them in terms of, you know, how do you find out, you know, for example, a lot of if kids are considered to be at risk for, you know, emotional abuse or physical abuse or neglect, a lot of those reports usually come from the community and the schools. So when the kids were not in school, you know, the number of reported concerns about children were going down, and you know it's unlikely that they actually were not happening. So you know, trying to get cases identified and then have the social workers go out into the community and the homes with all the protections, but they are all still there and still happening. You know, and so you know, the agency where we did our research, they're still open, but they're open differently. And then as far as the social workers who are involved in, you know, clinical mental health or behavioral health issues, some people are meeting, you know, face-to-face with masks on, and other people are, it's gone a lot to the telehealth. And as Dr. Frank was saying, you know, we're all really tired of Zoom, so that probably, you know, what that does or doesn't do to the social connection is, you know, yet to be studied. But social work is, there's a lot out there about, you know, trying to step up and respond and still be there and let people know that we're still there. And of course, anyone who is at risk, I guess I should mention that, if anyone is, you know, suffering any depression or loneliness, you know, to reach out to the human service agencies or to, you know, call a suicide hotline, which of course I don't have the number for right now. But, you know, that there is help available, and, you know, to know that they're not alone and they can get through this. So I would say that about the actual practice of social work right now, Scott.
I would also add to that, Laura, that, you know, social work is a profession that's all about overcoming barriers and reinventing, like, strategies to help people meet their own needs. And so I know I'm involved with a couple food banks that are dealing with this by doing a drive-through, right? Like, just reinventing what we're doing in terms of how do we get people the resources that they need.
I would say that is one of the things I have observed as well, is that in the last 7 months, a lot of people have become very creative because mm-hmm. we have been stuck mm-hmm. in the house, can't do the holidays, can't do the birthdays, just can't see the people or socialize like we have in the past. And people have used their creativity and imagination to overcome some of these things. It strikes me, too, mm-hmm. that this would seem to be a time that calls for people like social workers, because people mm-hmm. are, I mean, some people are suffering, but people who may be happy all the time are experiencing some mm-hmm. challenges that they have not experienced in the past. So it would seem that we need more interaction, more social work, more human service interaction than in the past. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that. I'm always in agreement with more, you know, a more emphasis on social work and the kinds of things that our profession does. I mean, the agency that we work with too is the Factory Ministries in Gap, PA, and this organization is pretty amazing because they really use this empowerment approach too to connect with people. And it's more this model of service delivery where instead of providing necessarily a program, they're providing relationships and network between people, and they're focusing on their strengths. And I think more emphasis in that direction, I think, is very useful, especially during this time, not this unprecedented time, right? Like when, you know, different people are also experiencing needs and social isolation. Like we don't, you know, to connect people through empowerment, I think, is helpful.
And I think Jen makes a good point that, you know, we tend to think of human service agencies as, well, I need to go figure out if I'm eligible for food stamps. I need to go figure out if I'm eligible for housing support or different other things. And those material needs are still very important and still exist, and social workers can help connect people with that. But we also, this recognition from our research is that the human service agencies probably need to also be not only bureaucratic and eligibility determining, but hey, you know, check in on people's loneliness or isolation. And, you know, maybe the human service agencies have to take on a program of, you know, would you like to belong to a letter writing group, or, you know, whatever it might be, that to assess people if they can't come in, not only for their material and physical needs, but for their social and emotional needs. And I wanted to just jump back a second at some of the research on letter writing when you were saying about psychologists and different things, Scott, that we found that the letter writing research shows that people can disclose at their own level. And so it's not, you know, if they want to share something and get something off their chest or, you know, reveal something, it's within their control if they do it in letter one or letter 10. And so it's a really safe mode also for people who may be suffering some things to, you know, begin a dialogue with someone, whether it's a friend or a professional, to say, here's how I want to share this. So it has also, not only for basic friendship needs, but it's also a technique that is used within, you know, I guess clinical work to allow people to disclose it at their own safe pace.
Sometimes the old-fashioned way is the best way.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Frank, something I noticed in you writing about the Poverty Project, and, you know, a lot of this we can relate to what you're studying now, is that students who met with or communicated with many of these people who are living in rural areas went in with preconceived ideas. And I think you touched on this a little bit earlier, but tell me about that. What were some of their preconceived ideas, and what surprised them?
Well, I think, you know, everybody has assumptions that they make about other groups of people, no matter, you know, if we like it or not. And one of the things that we were trying to do with this project was to get people face-to-face with, get our students face-to-face with other folks so that they could see, like, their humanity and that they could understand really kind of the lived experience of living in rural areas. And they really did. I mean, a lot of people that we met, like, had just great stories to share about their own lives. And even in the letters, we found that it was very unclear as to who felt like they were helping who with the letter. A lot of the, another theme in our letters was advice giving. And there was a lot of advice giving on behalf of the community participants to the students, because they felt like through writing the letter that they were encouraging the student to continue their education. They were encouraging the student, you know, to set their goals high and to dream big. And it was just encouraging on both ways. So that was one of the things that we found.
As social workers, how do you keep from your clients or the people that you're working with, how do you keep them from just becoming numbers?
Exactly. Yeah, I think that's a great question. And that's exactly the crux of the issue. And I think that in particular, the organization that we work with would never consider their, quote, clients to be a number. And they don't even use the word client. They say community member and stuff like that, like an empowerment approach, because really we're all human beings and we're all kind of going through life together and trying to just figure things out. And so just using this empowerment approach, using a strengths approach, viewing people by their strengths and their abilities and what they can contribute goes a really long way.
So, Dr. Granruth, let me ask you, the having decided now to make some changes in what you're studying and looking at isolation during the pandemic, how do you want this information to be used?
Well, you know, I think we would like, as you were saying, with not becoming numbers, you know, there's always a funding issue, right? So as county, and, you know, we just were in Lancaster County, in a rural area in Lancaster County, but we know that, you know, many of the areas in central Pennsylvania are, you know, rural, that as the human service agencies, you know, look for funding, ask for more funding, that they also just begin to think about, you know, what can we do to make sure people are okay? You know, how do we staff people and staff organizations to do check-ins even? You know, we know programs like Meals on Wheels, at least somebody comes to your door. You know, so what is it that we can take forward? There are also some initiatives, you know, increasing broadband access for those who, you know, Pennsylvania is trying to invest in that with a project that's, for, you know, public investment to put, you know, actually several billion into improving rural infrastructure. So, you know, maybe rural infrastructure improvement is not just, you know, can we make the buses run or can we get technology to homes? But, you know, if someone doesn't have a computer and that would be their only access, you know, maybe some of this public investment is, what tools do we need to give to the people who live in rural areas so they can access this increased infrastructure? So I think that's how I would look at it in that way.
Dr. Frank, you know, one of the questions that I should have asked very early on, but we've talked about it over the last 30 minutes or so, is what do the people that you talked with, that the students communicated with, what were they looking for? What did they want?
Well, yeah, I think what they want is a friend, first of all, because, you know, for the loneliness, they wanted someone that they could share stories with. They wanted someone that they could share their experiences with. But they also talked a lot about their loneliness, right? They talked about what it feels like. I had some quotes here, too, like somebody said, cooking for one is horrible, right? Just the idea of that, living to paycheck to paycheck stinks. And like Laura had mentioned, we had one gentleman who shared about his music interests and said, you know, I'd like you to look these following groups up on YouTube. Someone said, I know we will have a lot to share and learn from each other. I think they were looking for connection with the student, like an ongoing pen pal relationship where they could kind of share their stories and share their life experiences.
And if I may, I think it was also really important that the students were really surprised that, again, as the community members, were they were not negative. They were not cranky. They were very positive about their lives. They were very positive about moving forward. And they were not focused on, okay, you know, I became disabled because of a car accident or whatever, and I'm having trouble with this or with that. That was almost their side note. They were still so engaged in life, but just feeling like they didn't have the ease of making some connections.
I think a great lesson here is that don't go with your assumptions. Reach out to people and find out the road that they're, the path that they're taking and what their life has been like, rather than just assuming this is what it's like. Dr. Laura Brighton Granruth, Associate Professor and Master of Social Work, Director, and Dr. Jennifer Frank, Assistant Professor in the Social Work Department, both at Millersville University. Thank both of you for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Scott.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Vitamin D is known to many as a vitamin added to milk and other beverages because it works with calcium to strengthen bones. Health professionals now understand that the sunshine vitamin actually serves other important functions in the body, to include offering improved resistance to certain diseases and regulating mood. Joining us today is Dr. Meena Venegala. She's an endocrinologist with Penn Medicine Lancaster General Health. Dr. Venegala, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
All right, so vitamin D, this is, I don't know, I get the sense that this is one of those vitamins that we've heard about so much over the years that, you know, we hear vitamin D, we think of sunshine, being outside, we think of milk, as I mentioned, but it just seems as though in the last few years, we're hearing much more about the benefits of vitamin D. Why is that?
Absolutely. Yeah. So vitamin D is an essential vitamin. And what we know, what we've known for some time, is that it is crucial in bone health. And the reason is that we need vitamin D to absorb calcium from our food, and calcium is crucial in building our bones. So we've known that if we have vitamin D deficiency, it can lead to weak bones and can increase your risk of falling and breaking a bone. But you're right that there's a lot of data that's been coming out over the recent past that suggested that vitamin D might be involved in our immune health or in our cardiovascular health as well.
In what ways?
Yeah, so we know that vitamin D is involved in our immune system. Vitamin D interacts with immune cells, but the end result of those interactions, you know, is unclear. We don't really know exactly how it's affecting the immune system. Some studies have actually shown that vitamin D deficiency can increase your risk of some autoimmune diseases like type 1 diabetes, multiple sclerosis. But unfortunately, the studies that we have to date are not very rigorous. So they have not been able to prove that vitamin D is the cause of these diseases. However, the evidence does suggest that there is some association or link that just needs to be explored further.
You know, and I know I said that it seems as though this is a recent discovery. As I was doing my research, you know, I found that, you know, this went back as far as 2006 or 2008, where there were articles about benefits of vitamin D beyond calcium and beyond bone health, that, you know, the many other benefits. You were just talking about some of the diseases and the conditions and mm-hmm. our immune systems. Also, that vitamin mm-hmm. D reduces depression. In what way?
Mm-hmm. Right. So most of us have probably heard of seasonal affective disorder in the winter time, that vitamin D levels tend to be lower. And we also see the rates of depression increase around that time. So some studies have shown that, well, if your vitamin D is low, you're more likely to suffer from depression. And I think the caveat to that is, we don't know if vitamin D is the cause or if they just happen to be associated, because vitamin D also happens to be low in the winter time because we don't make as much, there's not as much sunshine in the winter. I think the take-home point in terms of the association between vitamin D, depression, many of these other conditions, is, you know, vitamin D is a vitamin which it's not harmful as long as you take it in a moderate amount. And we know certainly that if you keep your levels within a therapeutic range, usually in the range of 30 to 50 or 30 to 60, it can certainly help your bones and might reduce the risk of some of these other conditions, depression, diabetes, dementia, heart disease. I think we don't understand the full, all the details behind that association, but I don't think it's wrong to take it. And I certainly think in certain high-risk populations, like postmenopausal women who are more likely to have bone diseases, they should be taking it.
When you say 30 to 60, 30 to 60 what?
Oh, 30 to 60 is the level on the blood work. So when we check a vitamin D level, which we don't always do, but in high-risk populations, sometimes we certainly do, the level typically is measured on a scale, and many labs will report a normal vitamin D is between 30 and 100. However, 100, if someone comes to me with a vitamin D of 100, I actually think that that's too high, and it is possible to take too much vitamin D. 30 to 60 is at a range where you're not deficient of vitamin D, but you're also not taking too much.
How does one know if they are vitamin D deficient or if they're taking too much? Is the lab work and consulting with their doctor the only way to know?
Great question. So the blood work is the most direct way to know if you're taking too much vitamin D. Most people who take a multivitamin, for instance, are taking some vitamin D. They're taking usually between 400 to 2,000 international units in any given multivitamin, and it's in the form of vitamin D3. And at those levels or at those doses, the risk of taking too much is low. So I don't usually recommend that in people who are just taking a regular multivitamin that has some vitamin D between 400 to 2,000 units a day, they don't need to get their blood levels checked. If they'd like to know, absolutely asking your doctor. It's a relatively straightforward blood test. However, there are people who take more than 2,000 units a day, and especially people who take more than 4,000 units a day. Once you get to those higher doses of vitamin D, the risk of taking too much, and that's by definition, you know, having your levels be above 60, certainly, you know, closer to 100, is a real risk. And the reason why we care about taking too much or vitamin D toxicity is because taking too much can lead to high levels of calcium in the blood, which can affect your heart negatively. And it can actually also increase calcium in the urine, which can increase your risk of kidney stones. So I would recommend that if you are taking more than 2,000 units of vitamin D per day, and definitely if you're taking more than 4,000 per day, you should ask your doctor to check a vitamin D level and just to make sure that it's not too high.
Would it be accurate to say that there probably are more people who are vitamin D deficient rather than those who are over the healthy levels?
Absolutely. And especially in a climate like Lancaster, where we do have, you know, a winter where there's not very much direct sunlight in these northern latitudes, the prevalence of vitamin D deficiency is quite high. So, you know, I think that I tend to err on the side of checking vitamin D more frequently. But again, there are certain people, you know, certain populations where they absolutely should be asking their doctor for a vitamin D level, and that would be women after menopause, some people with kidney diseases, people who are taking steroids, which are anti-inflammatory medications, people with celiac disease. You know, these are all risk factors for weak bones, and they should be getting vitamin D levels and making sure that they're taking enough to get their levels into a normal range.
What are some of the symptoms of someone who is vitamin D deficient?
Yeah, that's the tricky part. Unfortunately, most of the time, you have no symptoms. Now, in the extreme scenario, when you have low vitamin D levels over years, you can actually have, you can develop a condition where your bones become soft, which is called osteomalacia. In kids, back before milk was fortified with vitamin D in the early 1900s, when kids didn't have vitamin D, they would develop a condition called rickets. which is very similar to osteomalacia, weak bones, bony deformities, so bowing of the legs. Osteomalacia, if it causes symptoms, and again, that's usually when you've sort of been chronically vitamin D deficient for years, can present with a deep, aching, bony pain. And it's very rare nowadays to see osteomalacia and rickets like we did, you know, 100 years ago.
Now, vitamin D is in some foods. What are some of the food sources for vitamin D?
That's a great question. So a lot of foods that we eat on a daily basis, like milk, is very often fortified with vitamin D, but you need to make sure that you're looking at the labels to confirm that it is fortified with vitamin D. Many cereals have it. And then there are other food sources, fish, so salmon, sardines, that have vitamin D as well. Egg yolks are a source of vitamin D. Again, I think the key is making sure you're looking at nutrition labels, and the nutrition label will tell you how much of any given vitamin is provided. And usually they give it as a percentage of 100%. So 20% of your vitamin D would be, you know, a fifth of what you need for that day.
You know, you mentioned milk being fortified with vitamin D. One of the things that we've seen with many children today is that they're using fewer dairy products. They're not drinking as much milk. Is that a concern?
So it's not, as long as they're able to get their vitamin D and calcium, for that matter, from other sources. And I should say that, you know, when we talk about milk, we're considering sort of the classic lactose milk, but there are other, you know, substitute milks like almond milk, soy milk, that also have calcium and sometimes vitamin D added. So we should just, again, be aware that it's not wrong to not drink milk from the vitamin D perspective, but just make sure you're getting it from other foods, or if you need, from a multivitamin, you know, or sunlight, which is another source of vitamin D.
All right, so let's talk about that sunlight. For the past 20 years, we have heard so much about skin cancer and being out in the sunshine too often, and when we are, to make sure that we're using sunscreen. How do we know? I don't know. I don't even know how to put this question. How do we know what is too much sun? I mean, that we're not getting enough sun for our vitamin D.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So our skin, it's a great question. Our skin produces vitamin D from sunlight. And you're right. There's always a war between getting sunlight, which will boost your vitamin D levels, and getting too much sunlight, which will increase your risk of, damage to the skin and of ultimately skin cancers. So you're right. There is always that balance between the two. Now, our skin does produce vitamin D from sunlight. However, if you wear sunscreen or long sleeve clothing, so anything that blocks the sun's rays from reaching your skin will hinder our vitamin D production. So, you know, you can imagine actually that people who have darker skin, they have the pigment melanin, that is a natural sort of sunscreen that blocks sunlight and limits vitamin D production in the skin. So, I know I generally am of the mindset that I don't want people to be out in the sun without sunscreen all summer, because over time that they're going to be at higher risk of developing skin cancers. And vitamin D is easily obtained through other means like food and supplements if needed. So I generally say that, you know, continue to, obviously spending time outside in the summer is absolutely fine, but I would say continue to use your sun protection and long sleeve clothing to prevent too much damage.
So you mentioned those who have darker skin. Does that mean that African Americans or those who have an ethnic background that have darker skin, they don't get as much vitamin D from the sun?
Absolutely. That is correct. Yes. Yeah. So anyone with darker skin, the darker your skin gets, the more you have of that pigment called melanin. And that pigment is, like I said, it's a natural sunscreen. So it will block those UVB rays from the sun that are ultimately needed to produce vitamin D in our skin. So one of the high-risk populations who I definitely am more aggressive about checking their vitamin D levels are those individuals who, are of any ethnic heritage where they do tend to have darker skin. So African Americans, you know, Asian Americans, I mean, anyone who has a darker skin color is at risk.
You know, that you were talking earlier about that that balance between being out in the sun and getting sunburned. I'm curious, when someone gets sunburn, is there a point where their skin stops? That vitamin D is not an issue because they've harmed their skin to a point where that they could be at risk for a skin disease or skin cancer.
So, yeah, I think once you've gotten to the point of burning the skin, there's such damage that I don't think there's any meaningful vitamin D production. And certainly at that point, I think you're exactly right. You're in that area where the more sunburns you have, the more likely that over time that causes damage to the cells in the skin and increases your risk of cancer. So I do think, you know, going out without sunscreen with the purpose of increasing your vitamin D should not be, I do not recommend that. But I think, you should always be vigilant about sun protection, especially in the summertime. I think moderate amounts of sun exposure, with protection is the best way to go in terms of the risk benefit ratio when you think of vitamin D versus risk of skin cancer.
I think, if we can take one thing that we can take from our conversation today is moderation is the key with vitamin D, probably with almost anything, but especially with vitamin D.
Absolutely. I think you hit it on the head. So, yes, moderation. I consider it a sort of Goldilocks model. If you take too much, it will harm you. If you take too little, it will harm you. You just got to get to that right middle amount. Absolutely.
You know, I have to just tell a personal story. Every 6 months I go to my family doctor for, a physical. One of the reasons is that my cholesterol tends to be higher. But just in the last year, the doctor has said, your vitamin D levels, you need increased vitamin D. One of the things he said to me was that insurance companies are really pushing vitamin D because they want to make sure that people who have strong bones aren't falling, that they're not paying out as many claims. Anything to that? I guess you could say that about almost any medical condition, but anything to that?
Yeah, that's interesting. I haven't heard of insurance companies doing that, but I honestly wouldn't be surprised. I think vitamin D is a low risk and also inexpensive supplement, and we know it does decrease your risk of falling and decreases your risk of breaking a bone, which are not only very morbid conditions for an individual, but also I guess costly, which is, I'm assuming, where the insurance companies are, where their point is coming from. I think, again, it's when you think of any preventative measure, whether that's a mammogram, a colonoscopy, exercise, anything that'll prevent diseases. And you think of, the cost or the cost and the difficulty of those preventative measures. A mammogram we do in women to prevent breast cancer, and there's a cost to it. However, we know that the benefit of doing mammograms outweighs the cost because you detect breast cancers, which can then be treated early. So that's why we do them as preventative screening. Now, I think of vitamin D in the same way, except vitamin D is an inexpensive, easy supplement. It doesn't require a great deal of monitoring. A blood test is really the easiest way to do it. And so I think it just makes sense, to take vitamin D in a moderate amount, especially if you're someone in one of the higher risk categories, darker skin, women after menopause, It just makes sense to do that. And it sounds like you were also vitamin D deficient. So I don't know if you fall into one of those categories.
I took my vitamin D pill this morning, so I will let you know that. Dr. Mina.
Very good.
Dr. Mina Venegala, she's an endocrinologist with Penn Medicine Lancaster General Health. Doctor, thank you very much for being with us today.
Absolutely. Thanks again.
Have a great day.